Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation.
That craft just stinks. We need
this
a new craft.
Like the craft. Worst pouring experience we've ever had.
It's a piece of junk. Like, just get a new craft.
Well,
welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
We're having coffee problems.
We are. I just got coffee everywhere. This is good stuff, too.
I spilled it on my hand earlier.
Oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
So I'm having some coffee technical difficulties with our first recording since Andy's been back.
Dun, 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 dun.
So you're back from your honeymoon.
I am. It was great. The wedding was great. Thank you guys for being involved in it. I really appreciated both of you reading scripture. It was glorious. And we had a great time in Canada. And this coffee is actually from Canada. It's from Eclipse Roasters. And it's really good. And Canadian prices make it good, but also a little bit cost effective. So
love it.
Yeah.
So it's Eclipse Roasters?
Eclipse Roasters. If you're in Canmore, just outside of Banff, you should go to Eclipse.
So I saw the pictures of the mountains.
It was so awesome.
And I was pretty sure, okay, I feel like he went west somewhere. Is he Wyoming? Is he Montana?
Oh, dude,
is
you were
he
right.
out of the country? And you were out of
yep.
the country.
But you had the mountain chain right. You knew it was the Rockies.
It felt very Rocky-like to me.
The Canadian Rockies were
you
really
were feeling
cool.
The picture.
There was. Can I tell one funny story? Or one cool story?
I don't care.
Okay. So there's like a whole bunch of stuff to do. And you can drive an hour and a half, which there's no cell service. And so if you're like using Google Maps to get there and then you switch to another app.
Trouble.
And then you go back, you don't have a map anymore. So we didn't have a map, but there were plenty of signs. And that's the only place people were going. It was the Columbia Ice Fields and it was a gigantic glacier. Mm-hmm. And you drive up on this giant like school bus that's got like 10-foot tires and they're super knobby. And it goes, I know, isn't it good coffee? It's really good.
Squirrel.
But we got up to the glacier and we get to walk out on it. You can like drink water from it. When you went to Alaska, did you go to a glacier, Charlie? Okay. So we hadn't had cell service the entire drive. And we got up there and we had 4 bars of LTE.
Yeah.
They so put I'm a like, tower let's FaceTime the kids. So
did you?
We FaceTimed Evan and Abby, and guess what grandma had them doing? I'm not joking, right at that moment. They were literally watching a Dude Perfect episode where they went to Alaska, climbed onto a glacier, and drank glacier water. And they literally, we didn't plan it at all. It was the most hilarious. They thought it was the funniest thing ever. So,
your kids.
That, I know.
And Dude Perfect.
They love Dude Perfect. Have you ever? Oh, man, they're hilarious.
No, I've not.
Oh, they're actually pretty funny.
I have like a cousin that works for them.
Seriously?
Yeah. And I think my kids were with your kids one time. And they were watching Dude Perfect.
Oh, yeah.
So my kids were introduced to Dude Perfect.
Okay, Tim, I know you like to go down these rabbit trails about things I have nothing to do with. Let's come back.
Charlie, you're so different.
I just have to wait. I just wait for, you know, we do it pretty naturally. But then once Tim starts talking, like, well, hold on.
We can't have that.
So
I love it.
Let's go through the rest of the announcements. So we already talked about Eclipse Roasters. Let's name our normie sponsors. So Brickhouse Coffee Co., Porchlight Coffee House. And Blue Cow, the friendliest herd around. So they are all a part of our podcast in different ways. I already said welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. I feel like we already talked about how we are gentlemen.
You missed the 200 for 200.
Well, I didn't miss it. I'm now going through it. So thank you, Tim. Yes.
Can I say something about Brick House, though?
Yes, you can.
Thank you for coming to my wedding open house to serve coffee, because that was phenomenal. The coffee was great. That's all. I just want to say that.
Mistakes were made that night.
Uh-oh. What? Oh, you had coffee.
I had a pour over. What time was your reception?
From 6 to 8 p.m.
Oops. I had a pour over at like 6:20. I did not sleep a lot that night.
How many years has it been? Because you've been really good about your caffeine and sleep. You're trying to really be careful with that. How many years has it been since you've had caffeine that late?
5.
No wonder we couldn't stand in the right spot during his wedding the whole time.
Oh, gosh. So there were a couple of times where I was pretty sure what we were doing was wrong, and it was definitely my fault. But the silver lining to that was I'm not going to let Tim make a mistake on his own. So I was like, if I'm going to send you out there, I'm going to go with you.
No, it, I did. I've watched it twice. It looked really well. It looked great. Okay. We watched it on our honeymoon. We're like, oh, this is cool. And then we got home and the kids were like, can we watch the wedding video? And I'm like, sure. But you guys, seriously, it all looked. There was like one point where I didn't know if I should take the mic from you or not and joke about it. But you, Charlie, totally seemed like you had everything going the whole time. Even though you only had 1 hour sleep.
Speaking of your wedding video.
Yes.
We're trying to get 200 reviews by our 200th episode.
That was awesome.
And so we want to get 200 reviews on Apple. You have to click the 5 stars, but you also have to click write a review and leave a comment for it to count. We're going to give away prizes when we reach that. We may or may not actually get to 200 reviews by the time we get to our 200th episode, since this is probably like 196 or 197. But either way, you should still leave a review and tell all your friends. And when we get to 200, that's when we will do the giveaway.
Whoop.
So it might be 200 for 215 or
maybe 38. We'll see.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
We will. One review at a time. How about we do that thing?
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books. And Tim, why don't you go first?
So I was at the library the other day, the public library, Ankeny Public Library. Wow. I know there were a couple of books there that really looked intriguing on the new titles shelf. One that I picked up is by Noah Feldman. The title is To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. So this is a 2024 title, and a lot's been going on in Israel in the last 9 months or so. And in this title, you know, he's like, well, what does it mean to be Jewish, especially in, you know, 2024? That kind of intrigued me. The book is extremely postmodern. The author, Noah Feldman, he's written several books, and he kind of tells his own story growing up in a pretty Orthodox Jewish home, but still in America, being introduced to the various different branches of Judaism. By the way, Judaism is a very eclectic, there's a lot of denominations, if to use in a Christian word. They don't use the word denominations, of course, but there's the Orthodox, there's the Conservative, there's the Reform, there's the Reconstructionist, there's several different branches of Judaism, and he's been exposed to a lot of them. In this book, he doesn't really just say, hey, this is the way Judaism really is, or this is the way the Jewish faith truly is. He patterns his book on Moses Maimonides. I don't even know how to say the guy's name, but he was a rabbi from the medieval time period. He wrote a book called The Guide of the Perplexed, and he's kind of written with that format in mind, where he doesn't provide answers. He just kind of asks questions and gets people thinking down a specific lane.
Was that Guide of the Perplexed or Guide to the Perplexed?
Guide of the Perplexed.
Okay, so there's a whole series, Guide to the Perplexed, for like various theologians. Okay, not that. Never mind.
No, but it might be building off of what he was doing. It introduced a book to me that I really wasn't familiar with, and I looked it up. I'm probably going to pick it up at some time. I'd just like to be a little more familiar with it. So the book is very postmodern. He makes a statement here. It makes me sad when often in rueful, gentle self-mockery, Jewish friends of mine say of themselves, I'm a bad Jew. They aren't. You aren't. There are so many ways to be Jewish. So many beliefs and practices and worldviews consistent with sincere and conscientious Jewishness that we should avoid calling anyone a bad Jew seriously or even in jest. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I don't know. That it sounds like, I don't know, when everyone's special, no one's special. Is that like what we're thinking here?
Yeah, or you can just kind of craft your own Judaism of whatever you want it to be.
It's just relativism.
Yeah, it's relativism. It's like the spirit of our age.
You're right. It's totally postmodern.
So the book follows a 3-part plan. He writes here, God, country, and family. Those are the 3 sections. He starts with God, which is interesting. He states, part one addresses Jewish beliefs about God and the nature of religious faith. It does so by introducing and describing 4 Jewish belief patterns that cross-cut the existing Jewish movements. I'm gonna skip a little bit. He states, I call these belief patterns the traditional, the progressive, the evolutionist, and the godless.
Huh.
And those become the chapters of the sections, the traditional, the progressive, the evolutionist, and the godless. I mean, some of that had kind of resonated with me. I kind of understood what he was saying, but those are not the traditional categories of the different kinds of Judaism. Then he's,
I mean, those are just broad cultural categories.
Yeah, they are. Yes. It's odd that he uses the word evolutionist.
Well, yeah.
Wouldn't you, if someone was to critique evangelicalism, use those exact same titles?
Okay.
Traditional, progressive, evolution, yeah. Godless.
Right. I don't know about evangelicalism, but Christianity.
Well, yeah.
part of, I think, the reason about 3 years ago, there was a big hubbub of do we change, not we, but the evangelicals, do you change the label, is because the left side of evangelicalism has been given up so much, and yet they try to retain the label. So I do think you could, I think Christianity fits just better, but
broadly
I even think
speaking, Christianity.
Even within evangelicalism, I think you could do that.
So his next statement is, I'm liming these patterns instead of using the more familiar terminology of Orthodox, Reform, conservative, and so forth, because the old group descriptions are not the right tools to use in deciding what to believe for yourself.
But that's, it's actually because the old the old ones are all relative or related to fixed points of truth, like you're Orthodox, you're Reformed, you're his are all like we're making this up as we go. Like evolution, I assume he's talking about the evolution of
doctrine. The evolutionist is essentially reform Judaism because what they're doing is they're evolving Judaism to a type of belief system that's consistent with 21st century life.
Huh.
Yeah, so that is evolutionary. So that's why he's kind of switching the label and he's using the word evolutionary.
Okay, so it's just the same categories with different names. Well, that's less exciting.
And then he states at the end, as for Jewish mysticism, it is less a belief pattern than an experiential mode of engagement with the divine. So there is a branch of Judaism that follow Kabbalah, and it's Jewish mysticism.
Oh.
Now, what does that sound like as far as like Christian labels?
Wait, so
Jewish mysticism is less a belief pattern than an experiential mode of engagement with the divine. For that reason, it can coexist with any of the four belief patterns.
Charismatic, because you can apply charismatic to all kinds of denominations.
Exactly. Huh. So that's where I thought this might even be helpful for our listeners. When we think through Christian categories, you have, I'm going to use the word evangelical, but that's still a probably too broad of a term, conservative evangelical. Maybe that would be like the Orthodox a rendition of, but then you have like the reform, the liberalism of Christianity. Okay. Would be pretty similar. And then within all of those, what do you get? You get the charismatic movement, which kind of has its little sprinklings within all of them. So a lot of times we look at the Christian faith and we think, oh, this is just the way the Christian faith is. Well, actually, if you compare it to Judaism, you have the broad stroke, the broad brush strokes of a similar type of a system. Probably the big difference is the godless. The godless category are people who are ethnically Jews, but they're atheists.
Oh, okay.
So those are people who have denied Christianity. They're like, but within the
deconstruction.
Jewish,
it'd be the apostate or the deconstructionists.
Exactly. But within the Jewish faith, they're still ethnically Jewish. So they have a category. He begins with God, and his first chapter is the God of black and white. The God of black and white is going to be Orthodox Judaism because guess what? God teaches an ethical system that is black and white, right? Or wrong. So that kind of just gives you a bit of an idea.
That's very interesting, especially the crossover or the overlap with those categories and just relabeling that. That's really interesting. So for me this week, I've got C.S. Lewis quotes, and then I also did write a blog entry. We were flying to Banff, and we were looking out the window, and I had this idea about God's omniscience. And so there is a post called A 30,000-Foot View, Reflecting on the Omniscience of God. And I thought it was very timely in my own life because I'm just talking about the fact that when you look down at these features on the land from up in the sky, you can see where they end. You can see a road start and where it ends. But when you're down on that road and there's trees all around and mountains and hills, you can't see the end. And so I just applied that to God versus our view. So if you're interested in that, if that sounds interesting, you know, hop on the web and check that out. But as we are doing this summer, I have C.S. Lewis quotes for you. This week's theme of C.S. Lewis quotes are his term, the unliterary reader. The unliterary reader. And this is fun. Okay. So in his book, An Experiment in Criticism, that's his most academic work in his field. He says the sure mark of an unliterary man is that he considers, quote, I've read it already, quote, to be a conclusive argument against reading a work. Those who read great works, on the other hand, will read the same work 10, 20, or 30 times in the course of their life. And I would say that that's definitely been me in my life. Growing up, I thought, oh, once I've read the book, I need to read a different one. And it's kind of, I think that maybe, and I don't know, maybe it's not this way, but I think it maybe comes from television. Oh, I've already seen that movie, or I've already seen that episode. And you're only going to watch it again if you want a novel, like something novel, like something new. I'm only going to watch it again if I think I've forgotten the plot. So it's an interesting way to look at reading. And if you're a literary person, you continue to read it to get more and more and more out of it than you thought. The second quote I'll give you is from On Stories and Other Essays. That's an essay he wrote. He says, an unliterary man may be defined as one who reads a book only once. There is hope for a man who has never read Mallory or Boswell or Tristan Shandy or Shakespeare's sonnets. But what can you do with the man who says he has read them, meaning he's read them once and thinks that this settles the matter? And so I thought that was good because I think if it's a good book, you should read it more and consider it more. And if you're not reading it more, what are you doing? But even like think about the Bible. We read the Bible all the time, repeatedly, over and over and over again. And that's because of its great value. So anyways, interesting thoughts. That's all there is. Interesting thoughts.
Why do people read something or watch it or listen to it once and then think, I don't have to, I've done it, I've already done it? So that is, I think you could really parse out the difference between the cultivation of the mind and the entertainment of the mind.
Exactly. I totally agree.
A passion is something that would overcome you. You would experience, you would have feeling, and you may even crave that again.
Yep.
And that's where you would go back to be entertained over and over again. But when you look at a book and you say, I already know all of that, so I don't need to read it again, that's the difference between passion and cultivation. That even if you know it, you would go back to it again and again to cultivate your mind, not to entertain your mind. And then what's the difference between the two? Your motive, your intention, what you're trying to get out of it. So if all you're trying to do is be entertained by a book, well, of course, read it once. You never have to read it again. So here's what I got. It's not a book. It is writing for Andy's wedding.
Oh, this is so good.
I wrote a poem, and I'm not going to talk at all about the poem. I'm going to talk about the poem later, maybe in a couple of episodes. All I'm going to do here is read the poem. Okay. And then after that, I'm going to give no commentary, and then you can just go right into the final meditation. I'm going to reserve the critique of the poem for a later episode. But anyway,
I'll probably have one comment, and that's it.
The title of the poem is, what did I call it? Let's scroll.
Oh,
Wedding Wisdom.
There you go.
Wedding Wisdom. Okay. So, come behold, hear this wedding wisdom on this day of life most winsome, for which friend and family do come to see the groom and bride unite, a day of joy and fullness bright. Ne'er forget the former days of dark, death's dirge from wedding song so stark, which imprints on all its painful mark. So distinct these days bring wonder, they bid us God's plan to ponder. God's plan, I propose, is mysteries. He out of time with fullness sees. All hearts, each pathway of budding trees, with orange breast birds sweetly cooing the coming of the life each spring. Past God's winter we in spring do come, and know his winter's cold and gloom, which pauses the spring's invited bloom. Winter's bitterness keeps our sight from the flowing sun full and bright. This wedding of trouble and pleasure results from heaven's torn tether. When man proved below God's character, with the tear waiting death brought sting and man's fear of no future spring. But with the darkness God wed his light, and in our sin he held no spite. For his full plan was his son to smite, his death for us the summer beam, his light brings each man's blessed dream. Behold this, God marries death and life, gloomy death seeks and finds his wife, Holy Trinity restores the strife, heaven's cradle robbed, son dies for thief, full favor found in hope's belief. Yes, God's plan is full of mystery, he weaves a perfect tapestry. Each strand is full of grace and mercy. Favor flows to man in sun scorch and turns to joy each woeful dirge. Wedding Wisdom.
I just want to say thank you. I've said that to you personally, but I want on air people to hear that I really appreciated that. And I thought it was beautiful and touching, and I have to hold my emotions as I listen to it. And you'll walk us through that one day in the future.
I'll walk through.
It'll be great. There's
we'll
so
critique
much in there.
It on another summer episode.
There's so much in there that's just really beautiful. Let's have a final meditation on God's word. And today I want to go to Romans chapter 1. And this might be a slightly different meditation than normal, but it's one that I think is like good medicine. It's good theology that we need. And it occurred to me that maybe some of you have not thought of this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read through Romans chapter 1, and I'm going to read through the whole chapter. And what I want you to do, listener, this is an exercise I do in my classes, and I'm going to ask Tim and Charlie to do it with me, is I want you, as you walk through the passage, to be thinking, what can a person know about God, but never has to pick up a Bible to know it? Because I think that when we think about people in other countries who don't have Bibles or churches and never hear the name of Jesus, I think sometimes we have certain thoughts about those people. And this passage talks about those people. And it would be good for us to understand what this passage says so that when we think about those people, we have the same thoughts. And then lastly, if I think about it, I'm going to talk to you, remind me about the problem of the unevangelized. So I kind of end that there. Okay? I know. Tim's eyes got really big. Trust me on this one. All right, here we go. Romans chapter 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth of God or the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And men likewise gave up natural relations with women, and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men, and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind, to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. Okay. So in this passage, Paul lays out quite a bit of what he is what he's saying about what people know. So in this, what are some things that people know about God that they can know without needing to pick up a Bible? Did you guys notice any?
The one that starts right at the beginning is the wrath of God.
Yeah. The very first thing that it starts off with is that God's wrath has been revealed. So I think you could say that it's been revealed to all, against all these people. Okay. So God's wrath is revealed, which I think that means people know that God is has wrath toward them. Okay. That'd be one. And when you look at world religions, that totally makes sense. Because people who are in world religions all over, there's usually some sort of action that you're doing to placate the deity, unless it's like a Buddhism or something like that. Any other things that you guys noticed?
So, maybe simply just say that he does exist.
Yeah.
But then it fleshes it out a little bit more with about the one that exists. There's things that they know. So his power and nature.
Yes.
Verse 20.
Yep. And that, to me, the two big things that I always catch are the ones you just mentioned, Charlie. So it is true. They know a God exists, and it specifically says his eternal power, which is always funny to me, because if I was describing power to a certain degree, you have like adjective, and then you have like the comparative, and then you have the superlative. Okay. It's like good, better, best, or much, many, most, something like that. But this is using like a time designation to describe the amount of his power. Now, I don't know if that's just an English translation issue, but here's my point is whatever it's saying is that he's like super, 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 super powerful. Mm-hmm. And where is that power seen? It says it like four words later in the things that he has created. So Paul's argument is that when you look at a tree, you see that and you know deep inside of you that a very, very powerful thing created that. Well, what if it's just the force? Or what if it's like evolution or something like that? What's the next descriptor you said? It's his eternal power and his what?
Divine nature.
Mm-hmm. What's divine stand for, Charlie? What's that referring to?
His we're going to talk about forms.
Ooh.
His godliness, the fact that he is God, that he is the top.
Yeah. He's a real being with a mind. Yeah. So he's not just a force. He's actually a God. And is it the New King James that calls it his Godhead?
That sounds right.
Is that,
I have ESV pulled up.
Me too. So I think that you can look at this and say that all humans who have ever existed, no matter when they've existed, look out at creation and know two things. One, there's something eternally powerful that created that. And two, its nature is divine. It's a mind and it's the God. So listener, I think sometimes we know these things, but then we think about the person who grows up in Papua New Guinea and never goes to church and never reads the Bible. And we sort of mentally assume that they don't know there's a God. And I'm not saying that what I'm simply saying is consider for a moment that if what the Bible just said is true, at some point in every one of those humans' lives, they came face to face with the reality that there is a creator God. Now, the other thing that I always notice, and there's more to notice in this passage, I just want to draw your attention to verse 32. Verse 32 says this, and I'm going to read the NASB's translation because I think I like it because the way it emphasizes this one aspect of the translation. ESV is great, but this one I really like. NASB says, "And although they know the ordinance," or like the command of God, "that those who practice these things," and it's that big list of sins, and then previously the degrading themselves into sexual sins, "they know that those who practice such things are worthy of death." So they know that if they do these things, they deserve to die. And then it goes on even further, and NASB says, "They not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them." I think that's a really perceptive observation. I've never once, well, maybe one time, I've never once had someone who was engaging in sin and I was nearby look at me and say, "Oh, you shouldn't do this. This is wrong. I'm going to do it, but you shouldn't do this." Like 99.99% of the time, they look at me and they're like, "Hey, you should come. This would be great." It's like Proverbs chapter 1, like the fools who are like trying to tempt the simpleton into their little ruse and ambush highway people. I did have one time I worked with a coworker who was telling me what to do. And I said, yeah, but you do this. And he says, don't do as I say, not as I do, which is a big cop out, but that's not the same thing. But I can't think of any time in my life where someone walking the path of sin, and I've been in close proximity, hasn't tried to get me to go along, or at the very least justified. I've never had anyone say, actually, you shouldn't do this. So, listener, every human who ever has existed, at some point in their life, this has been true. They knew there was a God. They knew that God was the eternally powerful creator, and they knew that they stood condemned because of how they've lived their life. If that's not true, then you have to say that you don't think the Bible is true, because that's clearly what this passage is saying. Now, I do think maybe there's one quick comment. So the problem of the unevangelized, and let me actually make a sidebar first. So in apologetics, part of apologetics is persuading people that a God exists and that the Bible's true and those sorts of things. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I'm not saying that doesn't help people. I do think it does. But I only think it helps generally Christians. I think because of what this passage says, if I was working with an unbeliever, my assumption would be that deep down they know something, they just don't want it to be true and they're suppressing it in their sin. So my entire apologetics approach is going to be very different. I'm not only going to try to persuade them to believe something I think they may not believe. I'm going to assume they do believe it and they don't want to believe it. And that's how I'm going to approach them. That's why my apologetics that I teach in class is not the typical, let's prove everything, prove everything, prove everything. You use those things, but you don't use them to prove that a God exists. You use to show that the arguments the person says for why they think that God doesn't exist don't hold up under scrutiny. Because deep down, I know what they really believe. I'm not going to say that. That'd be very arrogant. And they might not yet realize it because they might have lied to themselves. But one of the big questions in apologetics is the problem of the unevangelized. What do you do? Like, what do you do with all these people who have never heard about Jesus and live their life and die, and then God sends them to hell? Doesn't that make God a wicked God? Two things. That only makes God a wicked God if they didn't know what they were doing. And if this passage is true, I would almost bet that when I get to heaven, if I were to see the judgment, these people would stand in front of God, and I don't think any of them would argue. I think they would fully agree because they would be laid bare. But secondly, the problem with the unevangelized is Christians. Like, we're the problem. It's not that God's evil, it's that we aren't going. So maybe that's something you could think about this week. Is there someone in your life who you are around, who God's put you around, and you could go to them and try to get to know them and befriend them and share the good news with them? They know something. They may even smell something when they're around you, a really good aroma. Take that opportunity and go and talk to them about the Lord. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.